The Veritas Radio Network is guaranteed the right to offend, annoy, agitate, shout heresy, and entertain.
You should start programming right now.
Kind of like the cultural sewage served up on Bravo or CMT, only it's on 24 hours a day, except Sundays. When the truth gets you angry and you throw your smartphone, remember, no one is forcing you to listen to the truth on the Veritas Radio Network.
You can't handle the truth.
You're doing that of your own free will. That's what makes this country great and any gay marriage pointless.
That's offensive.
So there isn't much you can do about it, Chowderhead.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Grab a book, take a vow, and conform your mind to reality. Otherwise, you're just another Judas-inspired Karl Marx wannabe.
And your children will steal your credit card number to buy tickets to the Miley Cyrus Twerkers Ball.
I came in like a wrecking ball.
Are you ready? Let's get it on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
Welcome aboard. This is the Constitution Hour featuring Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. Wow. Boy, howdy. We've been doing this for a long time. This is episode number 21. You are listening to the Crusade Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. Radio the way it should be, and we're delighted to have you with us. Remember, if you've missed any of the prior episodes of the Constitution Hour, they are easily accessible. All one need do is go to VeritasRadioNetwork.com. Top of any page, click Crusade Shows, and then the Constitution Hour, and you will be presented with a list. We've also begun tagging all of our posts. Now, we're not finished with the tagging process. It's very laborious and very intense, but we have begun. And I believe if you look at episode 20, 19, 18, and 17, that the tagging process is correct. And there is a plethora, or let's see here, what's a better word? Plethora or cornucopia? A cornucopia of other episodes of the Constitution Hour and other shows and appearances that Kevin has made here on the Crusade Channel, where he is tagged to make it easier than ever for you to find new and interesting things and exciting things to listen to on the Crusade Channel. So check that out today. Go to VeritasRadioNetwork.com. And we are pleased to be joined, as we always are, by our host, the actual host of this show, Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman, who is now finally on a long and, or I don't know if it's long, but on a well-deserved rest from the academic year. So, Kevin, you're into summer vacation now, huh?
Oh, Mike, Russ never sleeps, man. just move from one work schedule to another.
Oh, wow.
So today I've been meeting with students about various questions in my role as chairman of my department. I've been working on taking into account my editor's notes on my forthcoming Jefferson Books manuscript. I've been working full time, just as if it were a regular part of the school year.
And you are also a glutton for literary punishment, since you've already agreed to write another book after the Jefferson one is done.
Well, the manuscript for Jefferson, basically the way this works is you finish doing the writing, you send it off to your editor at the publishing house, and he makes whatever comments he wants, and then you modify it to take into account his, little comments here and there, and
right.
That's what I'm doing right now. It's a very slight task. And the next thing is I've already begun work on my follow-up book. Besides which, today I submitted to a different publisher a proposal for a volume of all of Jefferson's constitutional writings. There has never been a collection of Jefferson's writings that included everything he wrote about constitutional matters. So I propose that there should be such a book, that I should be the editor. And so I'm going back and forth with the publisher about that.
Interesting. Well, I found that when I was looking at the TJ's writings in the past, that you would stumble upon. I would. I wasn't even looking for them, but I would find him commenting on some Constitution issue at the time or saying something about something that someone in Congress is doing and how he either gave it his approbation or disapprobation. And then I suppose, Kevin, you could probably spend most of the rest of the next couple of years going through the ANAS. If you had to plumb that to its depths for all that information, that's quite a lengthy volume, isn't it?
Well, there are several score volumes of published writings of Thomas Jefferson. They are in multiple series. The modern series has not yet reached even his retirement. So thinking it would be a long time before they got around to that, they spun off a separate series on his retirement years. And besides that, I think that the one-volume collections of writings of Thomas Jefferson, such as the Library of America volume, Thomas Jefferson Writings, and the Merrill Peterson volume, the Portable Thomas Jefferson, and so on, they tend to omit even obviously highly significant constitutional things Jefferson wrote, whether because they think there are other parts of Jefferson's career that are more interesting, or because they think that what he said about the Constitution is inconvenient to the political program the editor may have favored, or for whatever reason. So I, having just written this book about Jefferson that includes a lengthy chapter, the longest chapter on his various writings over time about the subject of federalism, think that there needs to be a readily accessible book with all this stuff in it so that people can become acquainted from the horse's mouth with his really radical commitment to the idea that federalism is the underlying principle of the American political system.
Well, I don't think that there's any doubt for those that have spent kind of time that you have spent reading him. And I know I haven't spent nearly the amount of time you have, but I could just think in my mind some of the things that I have read that would leave that would not lead anyone to conclude anything other than that he was if not a premier Federalist, or a little R Republican, as John Taylor of Caroline would call him, and had the intellectual moxie to back most of that up, too, and to explain why. I think that's the most fascinating thing. It's not just that, well, we ought to do it, or this is the way it ought to be. Well, the title of your book is The Political Philosophy of Thomas Jefferson, right? Or The Political Thought?
No, it's actually called Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary.
Revolutionary, but it had the early working title had thought or something into it. You're probing his thought process in your book, though, right? The one that comes out on Valentine's Day.
Well, yes, actually, I'm in the chapter on federalism. I follow him from his 20s to the last few months of his life, repeatedly recurring to this insistence that the primary object of allegiance for him was Virginia, not the United States,
right,
not the British Empire, not the Confederation, but Virginia. And I think that it's certainly not an exaggeration to say that he consistently insisted on this.
I wonder, as we discuss today's subject matter, and we're going to talk about the Garland Affair. It's a piece that Kevin has from the University of Chicago Law School. What history and the Constitution really say about President Obama's power to appoint a replacement for Justice Scalia. One of the things I don't believe I've ever asked you, maybe I didn't, I just don't recall, and it's been 10 years you and I have been working together, and that is, did President Jefferson have occasions to appoint Supreme Court justices? Since this is going to be our subject of inquiry here, perhaps that might be a good place to start.
Well, he certainly did, and he was hopeful that his appointments would change the direction of the court, which they certainly didn't. So this is something that he found very frustrating. Actually, I say in my Madison biography that Jefferson's best friend, closest political ally and successor, James Madison, may have made the worst Supreme Court appointment in American history. That is, if we think that the purpose of an appointment is to ensure that the constitutional views of the president are reflected in American case law, well, then James Madison's appointment of Joseph Story, who was an uber federalist, a close ally of John Marshall, was probably the farthest thing from reflecting the president's views as or of all the appointments that have ever been made to the Supreme Court. And Jefferson's own retirement years saw him in correspondence with one of his appointees to the court on this very question.
Interesting. And, you know, as you were talking about President Madison making the worst appointment, I didn't even know who I didn't know who you were going to say, because I didn't recall that little piece of American history. But I was thinking, like, well, I know he didn't appoint Marshall, so the second worst has to we go in order of worst to worst, but the second worst has to have been Story. And then I don't think he was around long enough to have appointed Justice Taney. So it couldn't have been Taney. So, yeah, it's got to be Story. What about the case before us here today about what this Garland affair says and what we may learn from the Garland affair and President Obama's power to appoint a replacement for Justice Scalia? This is a fascinating little case study, I think.
Well, a couple of months back, I had the good pleasure of speaking at the University of Chicago Law School. And while I was there, I told the students quite candidly that I consider the University of Chicago Law School to be America's best law school. Unfortunately, however, two people, one of whom has a temporary appointment on the faculty there, Robin Carr and Jason Mazzoni, have written an article in which they say essentially that the Senate's decision not to consider confirmation of Judge Garland to the seat formerly held on the Supreme Court by Justice Antonin Scalia is unconstitutional. And the reasoning they use to arrive at this conclusion is just entirely lamentable. People who've read my book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, will recognize this. What they say is, this is the central part of their argument here about the Garland mess. What they say is that we have, quote, an unbroken historical tradition with respect to Supreme Court appointments, which has plausibly ripened into a constitutional rule. So, in other words, they assert that if people in government act a certain way for a long enough period of time, that is tantamount to a constitutional amendment, making behavior of that kind mandatory. So they say that there's never been a situation like the Senate Republicans' current refusal to consider any nomination from President Obama to the Scalia seat, and therefore there's a mandatory requirement that the Senate not refuse to consider President Obama's nomination of somebody to that seat. I find this entirely implausible, although, of course, to be fair, you have to say that this kind of reasoning has been used all the way back to John Marshall. That basically, if the federal government has done something long enough without a court or somebody saying, well, you can't do that, then because it has done that thing long enough, the Constitution comes to allow the federal government to behave that way. This, of course, could be used only on behalf of more power for the federal government. So you would never see a law professor or a judge saying, well, because the federal government hasn't used this power this way for a long time, therefore it's lost this power, although it might have been understood to have it in the first place. No, no. This made-up rule is always going to lead us in the direction of more power for the federal government, more power for Congress, more power for the executive. And so what we have here is essentially a kind of partisan brief in the form of an article by these two professors, one of them at America's finest law school, saying essentially, well, Republicans, you must take up the Garland nomination. the Constitution, although we've never known it before, now should be understood as requiring you to do so.
I shouldn't say I like, but I'm impressed by the creativity behind the terminology that a longstanding historical tradition can ripen into a constitutional rule. I guess that's how we get all the things that we get from the incorporation doctrine then, too. They could just explain that away, that the penumbras emanating from the 14th Amendment give you the right to kill babies and for gay people to get married. And very soon, I suspect, other hell-forsaken proclamations from the Anthony Kennedy wing of the Supreme Court. Do you think that Kennedy may warm to this idea of things ripening into rules?
Oh, well, I'm sure this is not a novel notion among constitutional nihilists. You know, notice this is entirely at odds with the basic idea underlying written constitutions, which is that by having a written constitution, we have imposed upon the people who hold office under that written constitution an unvarying limitation on their authority. So if on one hand we have a tradition of having written constitutions, but on the other hand we have this idea that behavior of people in public office can work as changes to the Constitution, then we've completely vitiated the whole written constitution enterprise, because the only purpose of having a written constitution is so that there are unvarying limitations on the behavior in office of people in the government. So the idea that a long train of behavior by people in office can come to be binding or come to be authoritative, I think, is really contrary to constitutionalism. So you can think of several kinds of things that government officials long did and which we no longer believe they should do. And the argument here seems to be that, well, the way what they did before comes to be their right, or the way that they've behaved comes to be their duty. So, for example, when it comes to the president's power to appoint people to the Supreme Court with the advice and consent of the Senate, for most of the time there's been a Supreme Court, there were no Senate hearings into the nominations of particular people to fill seats on the court. And yet, in recent decades, we have had a consistent practice of having hearings. So how does one decide whether not having hearings has ripened into a constitutional requirement, or having hearings has ripened into a constitutional requirement? Of course, unsurprisingly, what Robin Bradley Carr and Jason Mazzoni have done is to take the side of President Obama. I mean, how many people are going to be surprised that the law professors are taking the side of President Obama?
I'm floored.
Yes, well, yes. I was shocked too. Actually, I heard of this when I, out of the blue, just got an email from them about it, saying, here's our article. We hope you'll find it of interest. And reading it, I did find it of interest. I found it illustrative of the general tendency of people in legal academia just to make up arguments about the Constitution that have essentially nothing to do with the Constitution.
This is true. It may be that this is the Constitution Hour here on the Crusade Channel, featuring Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. He, the author of Virginia's American Revolution, the aforementioned politically incorrect guide to the Constitution, Who Killed the Constitution, a work he co-authored with the great Tom Woods, or Thomas E. Woods, James Madison and the Making of America, and very soon, I'm going to get the title right this time, Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary, coming out on Valentine's Day 2017. So we're in very good company here. Kevin, many people that are listening to this show for the first time, or maybe newbies to your and my talks over the last 10 years, may not know that there are such things as constitutions that are not written. You keep saying written. There may be those that are wondering, well, of course constitutions are written. What are you guys talking about? The great Constitution of England of it came from the Revolution of 1688, I think. That's not a written constitution, is it?
No, and actually Americans invented written constitutions adopted by the people's representatives, and what they were accustomed to was what was called the British Constitution, which was not a written document adopted by particular people at any point in time. Instead, the British used the term constitution in their law to refer to a set of customs, traditions, habits, conventions, just more or less as you would, you know, to the life of their government, more or less in the way that you would refer to your own constitution, that is to your health and your stature, your build, and so on. So Americans, seeing the way that they thought at the time of the Revolution that the British government had changed, had become corrupted, and that British officials, in their view, were trying to exercise powers that they weren't legitimately entitled to exercise, decided on this notion of having written constitutions adopted by the people's representatives. So when the Virginians in 1776 put this constitution into effect by swearing in Patrick Henry as the first Republican governor of Virginia, they weren't doing something that other American subjects of the British king hadn't thought of before. They were acting on a theory that Americans had become widely devoted to, and within a very short time, 11 of the 13 states had written constitutions adopted by the people's representatives, and the other two, Connecticut and Rhode Island, just kind of rebranded their last colonial charters as state constitutions. So again, the idea here is that you should have an unvarying rule, unvarying parameters of authority of people in office, and that the people who hold office should always obey those rules. I'm going to note something else, though, about this article by Professors Carr and Mazzoni on what they call the Garland Affair, and that is they say that we're at some kind of crisis point because of the Republican senators' behavior here, and they say, well, this augurs really bad developments in future, but this whole description of what's going on ignores the reasons why the Republican leadership decided to take this step, and that is that President Obama, surprisingly, has gone even farther in a non-constitutional direction than his immediate predecessor, George W. Bush, had gone. He's claimed he's so egregiously claimed power that was beyond what the Constitution gave him that finally, when the chief figure opposing this course that President Obama was on unexpectedly died, the Republicans, believing that adherence to the Constitution in some sense was a central tenet of American political science, decided, you know, we're just not going to let this guy appoint another one of the people who support this kind of behavior to the Supreme Court. And actually, while Carr and Mazzoni think of appointment as the president's right or power, actually this is supposed to be a joint endeavor of Senate and president, and President Obama has been in the business simply of arrogating authority to himself.
Right.
So for the senators to say we are facing, this has not been what they've said, although this has been what people who endorse their course of action have generally said about what they were doing. For the Republicans in the Senate implicitly to claim that President Obama's usurpation is responsible for a kind of constitutional emergency, and that they're going to respond by using their valid authority not to take up his nomination, I think is perfectly proper. In fact, for them to have gone ahead and rubber stamped yet another Kagan or Breyer to go on to the Supreme Court and rule consistently that Congress could do whatever it wanted, that individual rights essentially don't matter, that the executive is free to rewrite statutes or ignore them as he deems fit or politically advantageous and so on. This completely to ignore the 10th Amendment, which Jefferson called the underlying principle of the Constitution, this would have been a revolution. And so although I wish Mitch McConnell had come out and made the constitutional argument for what he's doing, yet I am pleasantly surprised that he's doing what he's doing.
So with that brings us to the close of segment number one here on the Constitution Hour with Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. We'll take a time out. And when we come back, we're going to get right back to this discussion here. And also, it was on May 25th, 1787, that the Federal Convention began in earnest. And that's the convention that produced the Constitution. We'll have a sneak preview of what this sounded like when Kevin and I discussed this back in 2009. And I ultimately arrived at the spirit of 76, the movie, and how the entire process began and what the weather was like that day. Plus, we have another story from the Constitution Hour, and that is from Citizens and Statesmen, Volume 9. This is a journal by the St. Vincent College. We're going to get into a little discussion here about what is going on with the Obama administration and how it is that they have begun to bully people when it comes to their free exercise of religion, if they have any connection, tangential or otherwise, to the federal government. So all that is coming up. And remember, if you miss any of the previous episodes of the Constitution Hour, they are all available at VeritasRadioNetwork.com. Just click on the Crusade Shows, and then under that menu, the Constitution Hour, and you can listen to previews or download each show yourself. And even if you're not a member, you can download any episode of the Constitution Hour for a mere 99 cents, just like it's in the iTunes store. That's at VeritasRadioNetwork.com. This is the Veritas Radio Network, radio the way it should be.